Hi, it's Rob Herman, and welcome to the Super Performers Podcast, powered by 4100 FS. As we worked on developing this podcast, our overriding goal was to create a compelling platform for accessible insights on work and life from successful, driven, and highly accomplished leaders. Leaders with unique experiences across a wide variety of fields, including business, medicine, law, sports, entertainment, education, and philanthropy, among others. In my head, I started to work through a fascinating group I wanted as guests, and I got pretty excited about it. I've gotten to know these people through my own varied experiences early in my career on Capitol Hill, later working on Wall Street and as an investment manager, being an entrepreneur, and now leading a unique and thriving company called 4100 FS, while also focusing on community engagement. I think you'll really enjoy hearing the stories of these guests, learning about their respective paths, finding out what motivates them, and how they define success. Glad to have you with us on the Super Performers Podcast. And without further ado, on to our guest today. Our guest on the Super Performers Podcast is Jeff Birding. Jeff Birding is the president and co-CEO of FC Cincinnati, the professional soccer team he co-founded with his partner Carl Lindner in the summer of 2015. With its arrival in Major League Soccer, MLS, for the 2019 season, less than 4 years after its founding, FC Cincinnati has become the benchmark for organic growth and community-driven sports interest. FC Cincinnati hosts its matches and other world-class events in its award-winning, privately funded $250 million 2QL stadium. In addition, in 2022, FC Cincinnati announced the future development of a mixed-use district adjacent to TQL Stadium. Prior to his August 2015 founding of FC Cincinnati, Jeff served for more than 19 years as an executive with the Cincinnati Bengals. He has a long history of leadership in his community, including roles as president of the FCC Foundation, co-chair of the Cincinnati Regional Business Committee, emeritus chair of Visit Cincinnati, and he serves on the board of trustees for a variety of organizations, including the Cincinnati Art Museum, St. Xavier High School, the Cincinnati Regional Chamber of Commerce, and Xavier University. Between 2005 and 2011, Jeff was elected to 3 at-large terms on the Cincinnati City Council. He's also the founder of Build Cincinnati, the group of young professionals that crafted and led the charter amendment for changing Cincinnati city government to a strong mayoral system. He's been the recipient of numerous civic awards, including in 2024, receiving the Business Courier's CEO of the Year honor. Jeff's a fifth-generation Cincinnatian and a graduate of Miami University and Xavier University. Jeff Birding, welcome to the Super Performers Podcast. A pleasure to have you on today.
Great to be with you. Thank you, Rob.
Absolutely. So, you know, you're gonna go through many facets of your career, but let's start. And I've known you for a very long time, close to 30 years, which maybe ages both of us a little bit. But the reality is, I want to start from the beginning. Fifth generation family, West Side. I'm also a West Sider. Slightly different background than yours, but talk a little bit about those West Side roots. You went to St. X. Tell me a little bit about your family background growing up, fifth generation West Side family.
Sure.
Give us the background.
So I grew up in a German family here in Cincinnati, as you said, on the grittier side of town, the West Side.
We love the West Side, yeah.
And Catholic, neighborhood. I went to St. Catherine's, which grade school. Grew up right across the street played a lot of sports. We didn't have a lot of money, but we had a great time. Ryan Park is right there. So we were at the pool and the ball fields all summer long and played sports year round at St. Catherine's. Still friends to this day with a lot of the buddies that I grew up with. When I played sports, I played soccer, baseball, basketball. Baseball was my first love. Of course, grew up on the Big Red Machine, the best baseball team ever. When I was in the seventh and eighth grade, I played football for the first time. And my coach at the time, Don Ricketts, he saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. And I mean, he pushed me in a way that was hard, but really was formative for me. And then in addition to some of my teachers at St. Catherine's, they pushed me to go to St. X, the all boys Jesuit high school. And there the mantra of men for others sort of took hold in me. And it was just a life-changing experience. Most of my buddies went to another great Catholic school in Cincinnati, LaSalle, but I had a chance to go to St. X, and that sort of set me on this men for others servant leadership. I didn't know it at the time, how that would take hold. I wasn't a leader in school. I played sports, worked very hard to get good grades, got along with everyone, but I wouldn't say by any measure I was a popular kid. But once you go to St. X and that mantra gets in you, it sort of sets you on a life path, a journey. And for me, that meant I was going to go to college, and I'm the first Birding to graduate from college in my family and of all my siblings. And I could only afford Miami University. I really wanted to go to Boston College. I had an Ignatian scholarship. I wanted to stay with the Jesuits, love Boston, you know, get out of Cincinnati, get out of Southwest Ohio. But I could only afford, I paid my own way and worked construction to pay my way, and worked in the dining hall, and was an RA in one of the dorms. So, but had a great experience at Miami, and gave me an opportunity to be on this wonderful life journey that's been such a blessing.
Well, a couple of things to unpack there. First of all, Big Red Machine. When I first moved to New York, one of my first interviews, they asked me, since I was from Cincinnati, to recite the lineup of the Big Red Machine, which I'm sure you and I can do in our sleep.
Yes.
No problem at all. It's still fun to think about that lineup a long time ago, but still great memories. So Big Red Machine, we grew up in the same era, but also impressive that you were the first Birding in your family to go to college, fifth generation family, worked your way through school. All that's really impressive. But it's interesting also, because when we think about post-college for you, you know, you did end up in DC for a while, which is where I believe we first met. We're both working in DC.
Yeah, in 1993. So I think technically it's been over 30 years.
Yeah. All right. So we've hit that 30 plus year mark and still friends. So that's a good sign. But what, you know, post-college, what was your first role? How did you end up in DC? Was it always part of the plan?
Yeah.
And I'll ask you later if it's part of your plan to come back, but was always part of your plan to go from Southwest Ohio to DC?
Well, it was interesting. You know, when I was at Miami University, I initially was international studies, and with an emphasis on Africa because of the famine. You know, I graduated from high school in 85. And honestly, I couldn't master French. And in international studies, you had to have a language. And I had Latin at St. X, which was a big mistake. I'd like to take that. Do you have a do-over there? But at the time, Mikhail Gorbachev, of course, had become the leader of the Soviet Union, and Perestroika and Glasnost. It seems like like 100 years ago, but that was really 30 years ago, a little over 30 years ago. Anyway, I switched to Soviet studies, Russian language. No one in my Russian 101 class had ever had Russian before. And I thought I was going to be a diplomat in the State Department or work for an NGO, you know, maybe the CIA and intelligence. I thought of naval intelligence. So I really thought that's where I was headed. I studied in Moscow in the summer of 1988, was there with when President Reagan and Gorbachev had their summit, had some really cool experiences related to that event. Came back again thinking that that's where I was headed. But simultaneously, I had gotten involved in politics. I hosted Governor Celeste in my dorm room in 1987. He did the university days. And when he came to Miami, he literally stayed in my dorm. Got involved in a PAC and worked on a campaign through the Governor's Celeste PAC. And then when I got out of college, I worked for the Attorney General of Ohio, and then worked in the Ohio legislature under Vern Reif. And then in 1992, I was the state political director for U.S. Senator John Glenn, of course, an American legend. after we were successful in his reelection campaign, what ultimately was his final campaign, I got a job in Washington, D.C., working in a law firm that was doing higher education work in terms of, like, we represented some of the student loan programs, some of the participants in student loans. We represented some colleges and universities. And that was just a great experience. Of course, it was the beginning of the Clinton-Gore administration. So I knew a lot of people that were in D.C. Who I had known in college or different campaigns. And so it was an exciting time. And I worked there all of 1993 and had a great time. And unfortunately, there was someone who I was dating at the time, and she was in law school at Case Western Reserve and wanted me to be back in Ohio, which led me to then come back to work for then Congressman David Mann. And so I worked for David Mann then in 94. And after we were unsuccessful in holding his seat, I then ultimately did some consulting work thinking I was going to go to law school at the University of Cincinnati. And at the last minute, I changed from a law degree to MBA at Xavier, which was so critical to my journey because if I had been in law school in the fall of 95, when I was called to a meeting and asked if I what I thought about running the stadium campaign to keep the Reds and Bengals in town, my answer would have been, I'm sorry, I'm not available. I'm in law school. But instead, my answer was, well, I'm taking some night classes at Xavier. I was working for Student Loan Funding Corporation, which had been one of my clients in D.C., again, thinking it was just temporary before going to law school. And ultimately, I was hired to run that campaign. I took a semester off from taking MBA classes, and then that's what launched me from politics into professional sports. I started with the Bengals on May the 1st of 96, and I've been in professional sports ever since.
Yeah, well, we'll talk more about that journey in professional sports. A couple things to ask about based on what you described. First of all, given what's going on in Russia, Ukraine now, and you've seen Americans being imprisoned, journalists and some other high profile people. But and my wife is Russian, and she was in Russia a couple of years before the Russia-Ukraine conflict started. So I have a personal understanding based on her parents having immigrated in the 70s. But what is that like? You were there in Moscow, I think you said 88, which was a really interesting time to be in Russia. What are your recollections of that experience and looking at it now with a fresh set of eyes? Nobody knew who Vladimir Putin was in 1988, but what is your recollection of that time and how things kind of appear in the media?
Well, it's interesting because in 89, I went back on a exchange trip and I was in Moscow, then still Leningrad, and now St. Petersburg. And I was also in Vilnius, Lithuania, as they were literally working on their constitution to secede and reestablish an independent Lithuanian state. And then in 1990, I went to Ukraine from Budapest. I went to Budapest on a business trip, an exchange trip. And because I spoke some Russian, I accompanied these people from Ohio who were Hungarian Americans to Ukraine because, of course, you had to barter all the deals then because there was no currency. So I only share that to say I've been both in Moscow and Russia, if you will, and also in Ukraine and Lithuania. And what I would say is it's heartbreaking because you thought that there was a pathway where Russia, and I think at that time, the people of Russia really were looking forward to joining the world order, if you will, that, you know, the world union, where the economy and the freedoms that we associate with the West would be a more broadly enjoyed experience for people of Russia and those who grew up behind the Iron Curtain. Ukraine realized their independence with the accord that recognized them and had some guarantees that, of course, have been violated. and the Baltic states and other former Soviet republic established independence. I try to stay still well read. I'm reading Navalny right now, which was a Christmas gift from my daughter. And so I find it just heartbreaking for what the people of Ukraine murderous regime have done to them and the extraordinary losses that they've suffered. But I also feel empathy for many of the people of Russia who I don't think support the direction, but really have no say in this. And it has taken Russia backwards in a way that at the end of the day, I think Russia is far worse off today as a result. But I'm also a pragmatist that's the world that we live in. And I've certainly been supportive of NATO the Biden administration, with the support of bipartisan support in Congress, to support a democratic Ukraine, and to not allow murderous regimes change borders through violence. I'm quite hopeful that level of support for Ukraine will continue until economy in Russia is completely upended, and maybe then there's a new leadership, a new direction.
Let's hope for better days ahead for Ukraine and for global diplomacy, whatever that may mean in the appropriate context. Well, thanks for that, Jeff. And going back to your political career, and I have fond memories, for example, of David Mann, who, when I was in DC, was there. I'd run into him occasionally, but I knew you were running the shop in his congressional office. Let's talk a little bit as we take it to the next step, because I want to come back to your professional sports career and your leadership position with the Bengals for close to 20 years. But talk a little bit about the decision. When did you decide to run for city council? You served three terms. What was the decision process? What built up to that point where you felt like, this made sense and you had the people around you where you could make it a reality? Eager to hear that. And I think concurrently, you were also developing Build Cincinnati, which, for people that are listening to this outside of Cincinnati, may not know, Cincinnati did not have a strong mayor system, which was really a hindrance to civic development. And you were able to develop an organization that changed that, ultimately leads to a strong mayor system. So I'd love to hear, I know that's a lot packed into the question, but I'd love to hear about all of that happening at the same time.
Yeah, it was sort of a fun time in my young life. When I started with the Bengals, it was a great opportunity to be in professional sports. I grew up, of course, as a Bengals fan, in addition to the Reds. And I was getting my MBA, but I was still that civic mindset that, again, meant for others from St. X. And so sometimes I just believe in the opportunity of leadership, that Cincinnati is the perfect size city because, it's not so big that you can't navigate it, and that you don't have to wait your turn. And so when I was working for the Bengals after the stadium ballot referendum was successful, the city manager at the time, I thought, was completely screwing things up. I, at a press conference, referred to him as the captain of the Titanic, taking Cincinnati right straight at the iceberg, and was going to sink our professional sports future. He was unelected. I mean, I say this respectfully, he was just a bureaucrat. And no one was in charge. Everyone was in charge, but no one was in charge, and no one was accountable to the citizens. And so in 1997, I started Build Cincinnati with some of my buddies. We were all in our 20s. I think I turned 30 that year, and we were just determined that we were going to have a strong mayor form of government where the mayor is in charge and was accountable to the voters, and the mayor set a direction, a vision, and then the voters could hold the mayor accountable. And Anyway, people thought we were crazy because Cincinnati had a city manager history dating back to the 1920s and a period of corruption. But we were naive enough that we didn't know that it was impossible. We didn't know we were not supposed to be successful. And one of my great mentors, John Williams, was the president of the Chamber of Commerce at the time. And he sort of guided us a little bit and said, you know, I'll give you some political cover and you guys can work on this. And at the end of the day, there was a little bit of a compromise. We got most of what we wanted. And now Cincinnati has, a more executive, stronger mayor. And that gave me at least a heightened level of credibility in town. And so then in city council wasn't doing well in the early 2000s. And there was no one on the council that, which are citywide elections. We don't have wards and precincts and districts, but there was no one who really understood the business community or took a pro-growth mantra. And so I was encouraged as a Democrat who was pro-growth, who understood the business community, who was ambitious about growing the economy, growing jobs, growing population, but who also, because of my history working for John Glenn and David Mann and Tony Celebrezze and Vern Reif, could get a Democratic endorsement. And so I was encouraged by the business community to run for city council. It's a part-time job. I still have my full-time job at the Bengals, but I had graduated from my MBA. So I had a little bit of time, if you will. And I had volunteered at the United Way here in town for 10 years. And so, you know, again, I was a little bit of a known quantity, even though I was a pretty young guy. And so Mike Brown was very supportive. The owner of the Bengals said, look, go make Cincinnati better. If Cincinnati's growing, that's good for the Bengals. So I ran for the first time in 05, ran for reelection in 07 and 09. So ran three times, won three times, had a good experience. It was a period of recession, a national recession, deficits at City Hall. You're always cutting. It was always zero sum on who got cut and, you know, battles to try to avoid it. So think about, labor contracts and pension, health benefits. And I mean, it was a very difficult time. We did get our riverfront development underway, which was one of the things that I made a campaign promise. Did some things differently on public safety, which were nationally recognized in terms of engaging with the community. And anyway, it was a great experience, but what I found is that my life journey was not that I was going to spend, 25 years moving up the realm of politics. That I knew that my journey was to serve and lead in my hometown here in Cincinnati, but I realized that that was not going to be the path. And so when I stepped away from City Hall, I did not run for my final election. I could have run a fourth time and with term limits, but three was enough. And I was invited to join the board of my kids' youth soccer club. And because I had two of my three kids were pretty good soccer players and played competitive travel team soccer. And anyway, I joined the board and led the merger of our club with another to make the biggest club, and started traveling all over the country with my son's team. And you could really see the growth of soccer. While I'm sitting at the Bengals, I have all the sports data I want. I have Nielsen ratings. I have ESPN Chilton polls. I have commercial levels of sponsorship with top companies in the U.S., et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, I had this epiphany that maybe Cincinnati should have a third major league team, but not in NBA or NHL, but in soccer. And ultimately, I wrote a business plan. With the belief that maybe this was my journey, was to bring the world to Cincinnati and promote Cincinnati to the world through world football or American soccer.
Yeah, it's an amazing vision. We want to talk about one of the questions I want to ask you a little bit later is, you know, when you had that business plan written, if you could have ever seen, I want to hear more of the specifics of the business plan, you could have ever seen in the future quite the way it happened. But let's get back to that for in a few minutes, because I want to go back to with Build Cincinnati and all the things you're talking about, even building that political career, which didn't turn out to be your long-term path. but it gives me a perspective on how entrepreneurial you are. And I know from conversations we've had over time about various projects and things we've talked about, you're an entrepreneurial guy. And one of the things I think with Build Cincinnati is, in a way, even though it had nothing to do with professional sports, it kind of, I would imagine, built your chops on how to organize an idea and build it from nothing into something that was really impactful. And I imagine that served you well as your career progressed.
It has, you know, as I said, sometimes when you don't know, it's easier because you don't know how hard it's supposed to be. You don't know all the experience you're supposed to have. You don't understand all the rules that you're apparently breaking that maybe might give some pause. And I never think that I'm the smartest person in the room, but I might be the most determined or most persistent. And once I sort of set my mind to something, again, listening to others on what it should be and how we need to get there. But once we're on a plan, I'm pretty dogged about it. And I was just convinced that we were going to be successful with Build Cincinnati. Cincinnati needed a new form of government. We needed a stronger mayor. We were suffering a period of malaise in Cincinnati of decline. I was convinced that this was the right answer. And I was convinced in the group that we had assembled had the political skill to pull it off. You know, we had some Republicans, Democrats, we had independents, we had the NAACP, we had the business community, we got some labor people on board, sort of had everything we needed in order to allow it to be successful. And a change message is always a good message. And we were change agents for people that weren't satisfied with how things were going in Cincinnati. And I think likewise, my approach on creating FC Cincinnati was that we were going to be the change agents, that I think people were ready for something different in professional sports, that there was a malaise around the Bengals and the Reds. Again, I love both, so it has nothing to do with not being a fan, but I think a level of malaise where they just weren't winning enough. I said that there was going to be three, I wrote in my notebook, that this club was going to be built around three key values. We're going to be a winning team, a family-friendly, inclusive club, and a franchise that gives back and makes the community better. And candidly, neither the Reds or Bengals were doing enough of those three things. I'm not saying they weren't doing any of those three things, but they weren't doing enough. And I thought that there was a pathway that we could be relevant right out of the gate if we achieved brand identity around those three core values. Of course, the business plan, the five key ingredients, the first one was strong local ownership that would invest in the plan, that would be patient, that had credibility locally. And Carl Lindner certainly checked that box, and then joined by Scott Farmer and George Joseph and a host of others. We had to have experienced sports management. People previously had tried this in Cincinnati, and they were, I called them soccer fans. They were maybe even soccer experts, but they didn't really know the world of professional sports, and it's a business, and you have to have some experience in the business. Three, we had to have a top caliber venue to play the games. Where are the games going to be played? Ultimately, that became the hardest, but the University of Cincinnati, Nippert Stadium, ended up answering that need. You know, people are going to come to the game. Where are they coming? How convenient is it? How many seats are available? Different levels of seating. What are the facilities like for the players? So the venue became enormously challenging. Fourth was that we had to play soccer, quality soccer, pleasing soccer. I made the point, my son's team was pretty good, State Cup champ. It's the beautiful game, and it's free. And we were going to ask people to buy tickets. And so you had to have a threshold of the match presentation that people felt was worth spending, whether it was $10 or $20 for a ticket. And then the fifth and final one was to build the relevant sports brand, which was the winning, family-friendly, and making the community better. And I literally feel like the whole plan sort of was built off of those five key ingredients and then those three values. The marketing plan I wrote based on Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point. So I had my early influencers, initial influencers, which was the Cincinnati business community, youth soccer parents. I knew all the youth soccer clubs, so I got them all involved. And then the people that go to the bars on weekends to watch Bayern Munich or Liverpool or Man United. And we were going to get them to create a supporter culture. Anyway, we drew 14,000 at our first game, 17,000 at our second, 20,000 at our third. And by the time we were 4 months in, we drew 35,000 for a friendly against Crystal Palace. And it was at that game we tipped.
Yeah.
And literally, there was no turning back from that. And
for context,
for the record,
go ahead.
The record, the average attendance in our third division league at the time, USL, was 3,100. And we did that 14, 17, 20,000 in the first three games.
We have some friends, for context, that live near Montclair State University, which is where one of the USL teams play in New Jersey. And there were, like, for some of the games, 500, 600 fans. So the numbers you're talking about are pretty lofty. Let's go back to what you created, because clearly from what you were describing before, you're well connected. You had been involved in civic leadership, in a senior role with the Bengals for many years. You had a background of knowing the business community very well, who had supported you politically as well. But, you know, the names you mentioned are the top tier names of Cincinnati, obviously the Lindners, the Farmers, the Joseph family. How did that come to be? Because you wrote a business plan, and how did it come to be that you obviously knew a lot of people, you're well connected, well respected, but that's putting that group together to make it happen at the USL level. This, you know, precedes MLS, but it's really a startup idea, and I'm sure your business plan was stellar. But getting those people in the room to make this a reality is not an easy task.
No, it's fun. I'm glad you asked that, because I wanted to add for the folks listening. When I wrote the business plan, I took it to the owners of the Cincinnati Bengals, my bosses, and it offered them, I think I got a pretty good plan here. I think this thing can work, and that you could own the team in all or in part or none at all, lease the stadium. But what do you think? And their answer was no, no, and no. They just weren't interested. They're football people. They're right. American football people. So, you know, that's fine. Then I took it over to Bob Castellini at the Reds. Hey, I got this pretty good plan. I think this thing is going to work. I've done my research. The data shows that this thing can be successful. If we do it the right way, what do you think about playing the games at Great American Ballpark? Like, you know, the NYCFC has played at Yankee Stadium. So it's not without a precedent. And they had a little bit of interest, but not much. So I was looking for the place to play, because no one was going to invest. The initial plan was a $6 million plan. No one was going to invest without a place to play. So anyway, I started talking to Greg Christopher, the AD at Xavier, and Mike Bone was the AD at University of Cincinnati, about the potential of either developing a stadium with Xavier or playing at a recently renovated, with $90 million of improvements, Nippert Stadium. And at the end of the day, I got real traction with Mike Bone at UC. And about 10 years ago today, I got a call from Carl Lindner Jr., Carl Lindner III, to be fair, who said, Jeff, I understand you're trying to bring a Major League Soccer team to Cincinnati. And I said, I am. And he said, my family and I are really interested in soccer. He says, do you have your lead owner yet? And I said, well, George Joseph is working with me and some other folks, but no, because I don't have a place to play. And he said, well, you may not know this, but I'm on the board of trustees at the University of Cincinnati, and, you know, the UC is going to let the team play there. So back to my question, what would you think about us partnering and I could be the lead owner? And I said, well, you were on the list, Carl, of people I was going to call. And he laughed and said, I'd like to hear more about your plan. We should have lunch. And I said, of course. He said, what are you doing today? And so I went over and had lunch with him at Great American Insurance and walked him through the plan, and we shook hands. And by May of this is again 2015. By May, Carl and I went up to see Don Garber in MLS. We wanted to make sure we had a pathway to Major League Soccer. We knew we were going to start a proof of concept in the third division, but the goal was always to be first division, Major League. And anyway, he had nothing but support. If you know, maybe he was dubious that we could pull the plan off. but he was supportive of the effort and of Cincinnati. And anyway, Carl and I went to dinner that night, and he said, okay, I'm all in. My family's all in, but you got to leave the Bengals and run the team. I need you to be all in. And that was the first time we'd had that conversation. Sweat equity was a part of the very first lunch conversation, but actually being the president and of the team was not. But we shook hands, and I walked out of the, I went back to Cincinnati, gave the Bengals 8 weeks notice, and walked out of the Bengals on August 3rd of 2015. We launched FC Cincinnati on August the 12th of 2015. This year, we'll celebrate our 10-year anniversary.
It's an incredible journey. And so, you know, that lunch is pretty amazing stuff. You're sitting there in that conversation, and you're seeing this come to fruition. Was there any hesitation? It sounds like you weren't quite sure when you walked in at lunch what your ongoing role would be. Was there any hesitation in going all in and you know?
Yeah. So here's the thing. I love the Bengals. I still love the Bengals. And I enjoyed my job. I had a great job, a fun job. My kids grew up knowing Dad works for the Bengals. I didn't start FC Cincinnati to launch a new career for myself. I launched FC Cincinnati because I thought it would be good for Cincinnati. And I just wanted to have a little sweat equity because, you know, it was my idea. I wrote a good plan. But at the end of the day, I want to be clear. I had full on 100% confidence that we were going to be successful. I had no doubt. None at all. It was just a question of if Carl's the one putting up the money, he gets to decide who runs the team. So it's not that I was reluctant. I just felt like, you know, that was his call.
Yeah.
And once he said, I need you to do it, you know, we quickly, within a matter of minutes, got everything figured out on a handshake. And it's just been a blessed partnership. I mean, Carl talks about divine inspiration on what FC Cincinnati has been. And I think that's a good characterization. But I say this with full confidence and truth. There's nothing that's happened to FC Cincinnati from a good point of view that has been surprising, like the fact that we've already won a trophy, the fact that over the last 3 years, we have the second most points of any team in Major League Soccer, the fact that our stadium was voted the best soccer stadium in the world by the World Football Congress. None of that is surprising to me. Now, I will say the pandemic didn't plan for that one, so that was a surprise. And was by far the low point, trying to manage to build a stadium and build the infrastructure and the club through, you know, a once in a 100-year pandemic where, you know, thousands of people were dying, including my stepfather died during the pandemic. So of COVID. So, you know, those were scary times. And I feel blessed that I had a good team, of course, led by Carl Lindner, supporting me because, you know, I'd been in professional sports at that point over 20 years, but there's no playbook. There's no playbook. I felt like I'd sort of seen it all or knew people who had been through it that I could always pick up the phone. I mean, I have a pretty large network of people that I can pick up the phone and talk to on different things that I'm experiencing or my people are experiencing. And there's nothing for the pandemic.
No.
I mean, that was do your best as you go. And it was a pretty scary time. And of course, the team was terrible our first couple of years, which made it even harder because we talked about from the very beginning being a winning team. And when we made the transition to MLS, we were not winning. And those were dark, dark times. But I had belief in what we were building. We were still building the foundation. And I felt confident that once we got the stadium open, we would get the right leadership on the soccer side. We'd have the resources, right? Because stadiums generate revenue. We'd have the resources to go sign good players. And, you know, we'd get back to winning. And I feel very blessed that that has been our story the last 3 years.
Yeah, you've turned it into quite an amazing franchise. You know, clearly everybody's excited about the winning and the leadership of FC Cincinnati. Just to take a step back, I'm curious, when I think about the business plan, you talked about some of those attendance numbers. And with all due respect to Nippert Stadium, they've done a lot of renovations. I think they've done a lot since then. But it was incredible to me because the number of people that were there, the facilities were fine, and it was a major venue to play, but things like the bathrooms and the concessions were certainly far from perfect. It's an old stadium, and with all due respect, you made it work. So I'm curious, in the business plan, when you, you know, kind of thought about projecting attendance in the first year as a third tier team in the USL league, you know, what that was like. And also, you know, you went to MLS in, what was it, 4 years, give or take?
We were 3 years in the USL lower divisions, and then we got the successfully were awarded the MLS franchise in May of 2018, and they had about 270 days to prepare. And just to give you a sense, because it's relevant, when Charlotte gets a team, or LA gets a team, or Miami or San Diego, the newest, gets a team, you know, they get two to three years to prepare. And we had 270 days. I mean, it wasn't enough time. And frankly, people in Major League Soccer said it's not enough time. And when we talked to people about being the sporting director, they were like, nah, you don't have enough time to build the roster, the rules. Like, you just need more time. The league's setting you up to fail. And, you know, but we were in a hurry to get into the league because, yeah, maybe someone else comes along and they pass you over. At the time, the city that we were competing with was Sacramento. Everyone assumed it was going to be Sacramento because they were the big dogs of USL. And, you know, so when he said, commissioner said, we want Cincinnati, we want you to play next year. Like, we had some misgivings, but at the end of the day, we weren't going to say no. To your question about the attendance, it's funny. Our business plan was based on 10,000. Sacramento had drawn was drawing 11,000 a game. That was a sellout for them.
So 10,000 was pretty aggressive, right? I mean, that was a pretty aggressive.
Yes. Again, the league average was 3,100. Louisville had just started the year prior in 2015 and was drawing around 6,000. And I literally said, if Louisville can draw 6, Cincinnati can draw 10. They're a minor league city. We're a major league city. And I remember being in a car ride with one of my soccer spouse, Diego. His son and my son were teammates, and we always carpooled to all the trips together, taking turns. And he heard me talking to Carl and talking about 10,000. We're going to draw 10,000. Because again, the business plan was based on drawing 10,000.
Yeah.
Like, we're, you know, ticket revenue, sponsors, we're going to do 10,000. And I famously hung up from the call, and he said, dude, you just slide your ass off to Carl Lindner. There's no way in hell you're going to draw 10,000. you might draw 10. You might draw 110. You're not going to draw 10,000. And he laughs to this day, said, I had no clue.
Yeah, but pretty gratifying to have exceeded that.
Again, I was just convinced that the market was ready for something different. A different kind of major league team, with a different commitment to this community and to our fans.
From a leadership perspective, it's really interesting, and we'll talk about all the FCC related things beyond sports, like the new stadium and mixed use development and what the impact on the city is. Which, by the way, goes back to earlier in your career and what you wanted to do in terms of building the city in a positive direction, but. In terms of leadership, it's interesting. We talked about, you know, startup entrepreneurship. There's that you know, if you've read any management books about the circle of leadership, there's the entrepreneur startup mode. There's, you know, building a business. There's managing a business, and they're all. I mean, leadership is leadership, but they're all different skill sets. So, talk a little bit about how your leadership style has evolved, because you're no longer in startup mode. Now, there's many different things on your plate that surface, but it's interesting because not everybody can fill that continuum effectively. And it seems like you've bridged that gap pretty successfully.
Well, I've had to. There's a saying that if you're a winner, there's nothing worse than losing. And so I would rather win and be wrong than be right but lose. And so, if you ask people who have been winners in sports and ask them about their career, they talk about the losses. The losses stick with them more than the wins. They're almost losing is just the worst thing. And I only share that to say, I've had to change. It is rare that the startup leader who founds the business, maybe gets to 5 million, but someone else needs to get it to 25 million and someone else needs to get it to 125 million because they're different skill sets, as you said. The entrepreneur is not necessarily the most sophisticated, mature leader because they have that special juice that allows for successful entrepreneurship and risk-taking. And the only thing I would offer is I joined a CEO group and had a coach. And of course, Carl Lindner is a mentor. And I've really challenged myself to grow as a leader, as the CEO. And I will share it. You know, when we were a startup, I use this example. I think it's a great one. A lot of people want to climb Mount Everest. It seems so exciting, exhilarating. Think of the pictures, the selfie you get from the top of Everest. It's everyone's wants to sign on for that. And we had people signing on to build a major league sports franchise from scratch. And so in 2016 and 2017 and 2018, even as we became an MLS in 2019, we were building the stadium. Everyone was signing on. It was exciting. I could recruit anyone with, this will be your legacy, to be a part of it. You'll be sitting on the couch someday with your grandkids going, I founded that club. It's exciting, you know? But at a certain point, you're climbing near the top of Everest and you're stepping over dead bodies. And you're like, well, no one said that people might die.
Right.
I didn't know it was going to be this hard. I didn't know that some people are going to turn back because they can't handle it. After we opened the stadium, a third of our people either were fired or quit because they were burned out. It was not sustainable. That energy, that passion, that drive to create a club just could not be sustained. And people wanted to go back down to base camp. And I said, guys, we're not wired that way. See that peak over there? That's K2. We're just going to go down a little valley and keep going right over. And people are like, I don't have that in me, Jeff. I'm out. And what I was demanding as an entrepreneurial leader was just not sustainable. And so I built a leadership team around me. I say I don't run FC Cincinnati these days. I run the future. I run the enterprise. The day-to-day, I have people that run the club, whether it's on the sporting side, on the finance, revenue sides, marketing. But I surround myself with super smart people. I say if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. Get in the room with all the smart people where you can learn things. That's where you want to be. And I know what my strengths are. I'm a visionary. I see the future and I have some ability to see that vision and put it into places where then with good people around us, we can create big, important things, not only for our owners, my partners, but also for our community, and do it in a way that, people in greater Cincinnati can be proud of, because we are a catalyst for what is good. And we are trying to make this community better. And I think sports teams, our pro teams have an obligation to lead, inspire, and unite. It's not just a commercial transaction. Right. You buy a car, that's a commercial transaction. Your love of your sports team and the civic pride that they embody and represent, that's something much more than just a commercial relationship. And we have to honor that relationship in an appropriate way. A lot of emotion goes into it. You know, we allow people to maybe set aside for a few hours a lot of the struggle in their lives, maybe a lot of the pain. I've had people tell me heartbreaking things that coming to FC Cincinnati games allowed them to get past: death of their children, failed marriages, all kinds of loss, emotional, mental health periods. And FC Cincinnati was something good for them, something that they could look forward to, something for 2 hours could inspire them. And we have to honor that in our relationship with our fans. And I think we've been very good about seeking out opportunities to grow the enterprise in a way that honors that about our city and our people.
Yeah, I mean, that's really important. It's one of the reasons we talked about the Big Red Machine before. That's foundational for us when we were kids. We still think about that.
Absolutely.
Brings back positive memories. And I think it's a really important point. It's also interesting because talking about the sporting side of it, when you became an MLS franchise and you built the new stadium, which is incredibly impressive, but an unbelievable amount of work as well, it I imagine it changed your perspective, because you talk about a catalyst for change in the community. You got involved in the new stadium. You got involved now with this transformative mixed-use district that's coming to the West End. There's a little bit of context of West End Cincinnati for those that don't know it and how it's changed that environment. But it became more than just the franchise itself. It became around the idea of how you can create community change. Talk a little bit about that, because that's sure. a big thing. And I imagine that's part of what comes next for you.
Yeah, well, it's, when we were looking to build a stadium in an urban location, of course, we want to be downtown. It's where the energy is. That's where the growth of cities is emanating from, is the core. We had a location in mind. We had to win neighborhood support. It was in the West End. Just to give folks a sense, the Fountain Square of Cincinnati is at 4th Street, and our stadium's at 14th. So we're talking just 10 blocks. And it's adjacent to Over the Rhine, which is the historic neighborhood where German immigrants settled Cincinnati. But the West End is a proud, historic African-American neighborhood. It had been where, you know, African-American doctors and lawyers and business owners. In the 1950s, of course, what happened in many cities happened in Cincinnati. They put I-75 through it. A period of 75 years of disinvestment and decline and population loss and over-concentration of low-income housing, and the neighborhood had really suffered. And so when we suggested we build our stadium there, a privately funded stadium with some public infrastructure support, think of parking and moving sewer lines, utility lines, and things like that, but the stadium itself private, we still had to get the neighborhood on board and did all kinds of public hearings. And, I told our group, there's two groups of people here, not one, there's two. There's people who don't live in the West End who ideologically think it's terrible to put a sports stadium in a low-income black neighborhood. There's another group of people who live in the West End, overwhelmingly African-American, who live in the West End. They're not opposed to us. They're scared to death because change has never been good. There's been promises made and promises broken, and we have to earn their trust. We need to listen and then do the right thing. And we ultimately, that led to us signing a community benefits agreement, the first ever in the history of Cincinnati, where we made specific commitments. David Mann here, he was at the time, Rob, the vice mayor. And I said, David, why should I do a community benefits agreement? The Reds and Bengals have free stadiums and they didn't have to do one. And he said, Jeff, he says, I know you're going to honor every promise you've made because I've known you for two decades, but these folks don't know you. So you need to put it in writing in a legally binding contract. You'll still do everything you're going to do anyway, but this gives you an opportunity to earn their trust. And he was right.
That's a
good answer. 100% right. And so we did it.
Yeah.
And we've outperformed the CBA. The CBA is the floor, not the ceiling. But he was 100% right. And now our biggest supporters are the people of the West End. They're our neighbors. And when you come to an FC Cincinnati game, and I want to invite everyone listening to check it out, come. But, you know, a lot of people that are our guest services, people live in the West End. And we get, we do surveys and post-match surveys and whatnot. And then just anecdotally, people talk about how friendly all of our game day staff. And I said, well, they're friendly because you're coming into their neighborhood. They're welcoming you into their neighborhood. And they're proud that there's this world-class stadium and a world-class team and, for the opportunity to earn a little extra money and to feel a sense of pride and gratitude in their neighborhood. And we have all kinds of kids programs. I mean, I could go on and on about all the things we're doing in the West End. But it's just a wonderful relationship that I think is a model for how companies should interact with their neighbors and their community, because at the end of the day, it strengthens all of us.
Yeah. Well said. And, you know, more wisdom from David Mann. But as you said, he was absolutely right. And you were going to honor it regardless, but put it in writing, build a level of trust. And I think it's worked beautifully. I That's a really compelling story and vision you've laid out. So I have two more questions to ask you. One is, you know, and you've talked about impact, positive impact, but you're in the press a lot because you're involved from a civic perspective. You're a leader in the community. And for example, related to the new arena down by the waterfront, not FCC related,
yes,
but you know, serving in a community leadership role, talking about the new arena. Obviously, the FC Cincinnati Foundation has done a lot, but you've been involved and continue to be involved. I don't know where you find the time. As you said, you know, you had a little spare time when you did Build Cincinnati while you were doing many other things many years ago. You've taken that to heart and continued to make a positive impact. But how do you prioritize that civic involvement? Because a lot of what you do on a day-to-day basis as your day job, so to speak, is impacting the community. Do you try to tie it all together? Or how do you kind of think about that civic involvement at this point in your career and life?
Yeah, Rob, it's a really good question, and I wish I had a more clear answer. What I would say is this: back to the feedback that Mike Brown gave me, Jeff, if you go make Cincinnati better, that's good for the Bengals. And my partner Carl Lindner, his family is the first family of Cincinnati. I mean, so much of the good that has happened in Cincinnati over the last 75 years, a lot of it has had the leadership, the support with the Lindner family. And so at some level, I believe that for those who much is given, much is expected. God's blessed me to be in this position. God's blessed me with talent to serve, with this vision and clarity around purpose, to be effective. And I think that God wants me to use these gifts in a way to serve. And for me, where I've decided I'm going to serve is in this manner as a leader in Cincinnati. I'm very close with the mayor, close with the county commissioners. I'm close with council members. I don't need to be the elected. I want them to take all the credit. I'm not asking for votes. They take all the credit, but I can be someone in the business community who's helping make things happen in the same way John Williams, my mentor, did when he was the president of the Chamber of Commerce. And I'm not the only one. I mean, Brendan Call is the president of our chamber, and many others are all involved in all of this, because it takes all of us to move the needle in an ultra competitive era. What I would say is this: I have a hard time saying no. And so, I was the board chair of our Convention and Visitors Bureau for almost 4 years, just stepped off of that. And that was where my call for the new arena came from, is we're missing out without a new arena. We're missing out because we didn't have an active sports corporation. We're about to relaunch the sports corp. That was me at Visit Cincy as the board chair saying, we can't, of the top cities in America, we currently have the worst arena. That's not something for winners. That's something for losers. And I refuse to be a loser. Not having a sports commission, missing out on sports tourism and big time world-class sports events. There's opportunities, but we're missing out because we don't have a sports corporation. That's losing. That's not winning. Obviously the Jesuit influence I've spoken of. And so I'm in my second year on the St. X, my high school board of trustees. This year, I was asked to join the board at Xavier University, which I'm very excited to be on. And obviously, real changing times in college admissions with the demographic changes in our country. And of course, even more so in college athletics, in what's happening with the House settlement and NIL and other. So how do we adjust to that? So it's an important time. I'm on the art museum board. I joke I'm probably the only West Sider who's maybe ever been on the board of the art museum, but it allows me to learn about art, expand my horizons. Again, this wouldn't be my natural state, but I enjoy our art museum. We have a great art museum, and how do we make sure that it's here for generations to come is an important strategic imperative. I'm helping out with the Flying Pig Marathon. I've run the Flying Pig a bunch of times, and It's been voted the best marathon in the U.S., which I know people say, well, Boston, New York, Chicago. I'm only sharing that we were voted by marathon runners the best. So there, it's a great marathon. You know, we have our FC Cincinnati Foundation, which we've talked about a little bit here. The Cincinnati Regional Business Committee, I've co-chaired now for 2 years, which is sort of like the, not the top 25 companies in Cincinnati, but like the next 100. But, you know, at the end of the day, someone has to serve. And I like the opportunity to be in these positions because then I have the ability to get things done. And what I would say is, to be fair, it's good for FC Cincinnati because it improves. I'm representing FC Cincinnati when I'm in these meetings, people. So it improves the reach and improves the relationships, and people see an authentic commitment to the community is represented by me on behalf of FC Cincinnati.
Yeah, doing well by doing good, certainly an element of that. But also, you know, from the earlier part of the conversation, you served in different ways for a long time. So I think those formative years you talked about is kind of a through line here. And you know, I guess the last thing I would ask you, you know, thank you for all you've done in the community to make a positive impact. But your profile, look, you were a city councilman, so you had a decent profile, senior executive at the Bengals even before FCC. But between, you know, the leadership at FCC, all the things related to that, all the civic involvement, your profile is as high as it's ever been. People know you in Cincinnati, certainly, but now even increasingly outside of it in the region. How has that impacted you? Because that's a different place to be, where you go somewhere and people recognize you. It's a different mentality. Maybe people bother you too. I don't think you've ever, as you talked about with Build Cincinnati and other things you've done, you were never afraid to speak your mind, even in politics, which I give you a lot of credit for. So it wasn't like you ever shied away from saying things. But how does that impact you? Because not everybody reacts positively to somebody that's in the limelight on a frequent basis.
Yeah. So I would say this. I'm probably pretty blessed in professional sports and unique, and that I'm a former elected official. And it was right at the eve of social media. And so I say that to say I have pretty thick skin. I had someone when I was a board chair who was the president of the organization, and I used to say to her, a lion doesn't care what the gazelles think. A lion eats the gazelles. Quit caring about the gazelles. Just be a lion. Like, you're the president. You're in charge. Yeah. And so look, that's never been, I was not the popular kid in high school, as I said, or grade school. So the popularity thing has never been critical to me. I'm comfortable in my own skin. I have a lovely wife who we're happy, and three kids that like me most of the time, love me, I think, most of the time. You know, at the end of the day, those are the things that matter. And, you know, I got EY Entrepreneur of the Year, Regional Entrepreneur of the Year a few years ago. I went to Scottsdale, and that was probably the first time I did have a little bit of like, this is the guy that created FC Cincinnati from scratch. And, you know, that was sort of cool, but I don't live for those things. I just don't. I'm in a FIFA diploma program now, which is, I will say, is pretty cool. So I'm meeting soccer people from all over the world, some of the biggest clubs, literally all the continents, and some great relationships. And I'm learning a ton about soccer. And I find that to be great because of the relationships and the learning. But the other thing I'll say, and I tell it to my people, people know who FC Cincinnati are. Like, they know about us. Like, what we've achieved in a short period of time is pretty remarkable, and people respect it. And I guess at some level, I get satisfaction from that, definitely.
That's got to be very gratifying. That's a great note to end on. Congratulations on all your success, a life well lived. Jeff, it's a pleasure to be your friend and to have had this conversation with you. I look forward to connecting again soon, but thanks very much for being on the Super Performers Podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Really appreciate the opportunity, and cheers to you. Hope to see you soon.
To learn more about FC Cincinnati, visit their website at fccincinnati.com.
And for show notes and a summary of this episode, go to 4100fs.com/news. Thanks again for joining us on the Super Performance Podcast today, powered by 4100FS. I hope you not only enjoyed listening, but you found the insights thought-provoking and relevant. We'll be back soon with another episode of Super Performers Insights from the Driven. This is Rob Herman. Bye for now.